Week on the show, Kubernetes and back. Why the author here doesn't run distributed systems, the reason NetApp's strategic contributions to FreeBSD on the FreeBSD Foundation's blog, which is a deep dive into upstreaming efforts. Then we have second part of the Make Your Own FreeBSD Server tutorial, adding webmail and more with Nextcloud. Then we have a tutorial for you how to run PuderAir on Apple Silicon, and one less Unixy option for 32-bit PowerPC and what that entails, and more in this week's episode of BSD Now. BSD Now, episode 555, exactly 555 episodes. PuderAiring Apple Silicon is the name, and it's recorded on the 3rd of April 2024. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDnow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDnow. And we thank you in advance for that. Hi, we are your hosts, Benedikt Kreuschling.
And I'm Jason Tubner.
Exactly. Welcome to another episode. We have now 555 episodes. Yeah, this is just crazy.
Sounds like a phone number off a US movie, 555.
Yeah. Yeah. What can I say? Yeah. It's spectacular. Yeah,
it's
definitely
been going on for quite some time. You know, I think back at some of the first episodes. What was that back in, like, you know, 11 years ago, I think it was around about then.
Yeah, oh, wow, yeah, with Chris and Alan.
Yes, it's been some time, hasn't it? Mm. But anyway, it leads us into the first article for the week, Kubernetes and back, why I don't run distributed systems. This is published over on David.io as a blog post of his. So the article reads, "It's almost outrageous to say that I don't like distributed systems while working in a company that advertises as being cloud native, headless and whatnot, and probably with every SRE with some buzzword certifications may think I'm a complete idiot. But hear me out. Roughly a year ago, I decided to switch to a Kubernetes-based multi-node environment with one of my side projects. The promise of doing zero downtime deployments and node maintenance, better scalability and self-healing if a node goes down sounded too good not to jump on the ever-growing train of tech marketing. I took a moment to calculate the cost of hosting my app on the K8's offering of a hyperscaler like AWS, Google or Azure just to figure out that this won't be an option for me. So self-hosting it is. Set up 6 VMs, workers and control planes, which ran me a low three-figure price per month, and set up Kubernetes. I spent an enormous amount of time to get the K8 specs for my application just right, migrating away from a single machine Docker Compose environment with a proper cloud volumes distribution, a MongoDB set up with 3 replicas, multiple replicas per pod for all my services, load balancers, and so on. I ended up with an, in theory, highly available system. Not all was great. I instantly missed ZFS on my volumes, which I used before to snapshot my application state before backing up. I also recognized that due to the replication that was a mess up to set up, I was wondering who engineered that over at MongoDB folks. My database became quite slow because I wanted to have the highest level of data replication safety, not to even start talking about the Redis and Elasticsearch clusters. With every replication I set up, the system became more confusing and I ran into multiple situations where I was facing performance problems that were extremely expensive and complex to debug. Once the application started running and I was actually hit with customer traffic, I reran the same tests that I ran before when I set up the system to ensure the HA setup was working. Killing a worker node from the Cloud VM control panel took the cluster painfully long to recognize the node was gone. The MongoDB replication needed multiple seconds to figure out what to do now. In the end, the application had a downtime of a minute or so, not necessarily the setup that was expected from a fully redundant system. It took me much tweaking, reading about different networking plugins, adding additional heartbeats and health checks, etc., to make everything working to an extent that I could pull down a node with confidence, even without tainting it before. In the end, this is what happened with an outage. In the end, it still was a multi-second downtime. Backing up also caused me headaches and nightmares. My MongoDB DB is so big that I cannot reasonably dump it anymore. Normally, I'd snapshot the FS and back that up. But how do you do that if your CSI driver does not support BTRFS or ZFS? So some more working around, some more complexity to end up with a CI pipeline that stops one of my MongoDB replicas, backs up the DB in a cold state, then resumes it again, which causes unnecessary load on the rest of the cluster to bring up the replication again. And what happens if a node goes down during a backup, which I need to do quite often? Then my replication has no quorum and all remaining nodes just start screaming while the application is down again. Are there any solutions to all this? Probably. But by the time I got to somewhere somewhat of a working state, everything became so complex that it really was a pain to maintain this whole thing. And it got a lot more expensive, of course. This is where I stopped and thought, okay, hey, is it really worth it? Well, I guess that depends on your use case, but for me, it's not. And by then, I really started questioning what Kubernetes is even good for after all. I'm exaggerating, of course, but think about it. The promise is that you have an abstracted platform that allows you to run distributed workloads, oftentimes by running containers that you never inspected too closely. Or did you really ever look into how Cert Manager works? Pretty sure you didn't, but sure enough, you have that Helm chart somewhere in your Ansible playbook. But does it really deliver on it? Distributed systems predate Kubernetes and Docker and probably all modern technology stacks. And contrary to all the marketing efforts by cloud vendors, you still need to know all of those low-level things. How does database replication work? What load balancing paradigms do exist? How can I set up a private network for my internal services and expose that service publicly? How do I configure a firewall properly? What was the stupid command again to set up that static route? And this is what everybody quietly ignores. Nobody gets asked about in their Kubernetes certification and what everybody is overwhelmed with as soon as things don't go and work like described in the docs. But then you are bad SRE. You still need to know all of that, plus all the stupid Kubernetes object types, specialities of your vendor's cloud controllers, and how all the shitty services are called again on Azure. So in the end, the cognitive load and application complexity with all that, possible bugs, security issues, etc., is way higher than it was with traditional siloed approaches. Today, I'm back with my single machine that handles the peak 500 concurrent users. It costs me around $40 a month, and it's faster. I have a cold spare VM ready to bring up operation by booting it up, updating the application to the latest state, remounting the cloud volume, and reallocating the floating IP. That's a single shell script, of course, running inside the GitLab CI pipeline. Of course, we're fancy. The whole operation is faster than it was with the optimized Kubernetes configuration when I killed one of those nodes. But those single machines now, understandable and debuggable. I have a script with that heartbeats the production machine, and if it's down for a certain amount of time, it'll start that script. Is that faster than the HA cluster? No, but it's way easier to understand, and I don't really need more for my use case. A few minutes in the event of a cloud VM going down every few years sounds bearable if you don't lose millions during that time. Or to put it with words of the prime again, just put it on a server. So do I hate Kubernetes? Of course not. All I'm saying, choose your weapons carefully. You wouldn't be the first person to shoot yourself in the foot with the very weapon you bought to defend yourself.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, I'm one of these people that like the old school and, you know, people go, you know, the latest shiny and that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, I just need to get a job done. And if the job works, you know, well, and I get a maintenance window every now and then, happy days.
Yeah. I haven't seen too much of Kubernetes that would convince me to try it out, and I fear its complexity. But yeah, I am not too qualified to make a statement pro or con Kubernetes.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you use Kubernetes, or do any of your colleagues use Kubernetes at work?
So at work, since I'm in the operating system group, or at least partial, it's probably unavoidable at one point, or at least they want me to get into this space. But so far, I was able to, you know, dodge that bullet. They use a lot of Docker containers already, but at this point, I'm not targeted for making that work or managing that. I need training anyway for this kind of thing, or need time to get into this part. But it's not like the most pressing thing that we are doing at the moment.
Yeah, you get away.
First, the upcoming semester, and then the other things we have in the backlog.
You could always just stay in the server stream and, you know, be the subject matter expert in that space and just go, I'm happy there.
Yeah. And there's also, we have central IP or IT departments that will probably also want to have something like that and provide some services to our users, similar to what we have with OpenStack at the moment. And so it's debatable how much I will be involved or how deep I will be involved, if anything at all. Okay, next up in our news, we have from the FreeBSD Foundation's blog, NetApp Strategic Contributions to FreeBSD, a deep dive into upstreaming efforts. Yes, it's published on April 1st. No, not everything that you read on April 21st is just fake news. And seriously, the rest of the year is also full of fake news. So
yeah, I think if I was an organization, I would just hold off on doing any. Just release it like on March 31st or April 2nd. It's just like, just don't bother, because then that way users aren't going to get confused.
Yeah, but definitely think for yourself if this is valid or not, or has the right grains of salt. So starting off. Open source software leads the way in technology innovation, and corporate contributions to these community-driven projects significantly shape these resources. NetApp is a great example of this, as it has made strategic and multifaceted efforts to contribute to FreeBSD. This decision goes beyond technical needs, reflecting a deliberate choice to align with FreeBSD's robustness, security, and performance strengths. By upstreaming code enhancements and fixes to the FreeBSD project, NetApp enriches this ecosystem and taps into a collective pool of expertise to advance its flagship ONTAP software, underscoring a symbiotic relationship that drives mutual growth and innovation. And yes, they, NetApp has been contributing to conferences and to development efforts and to the FreeBSD Foundation for many, many years. And that also provides a lot of advantages for the project. Going on, the genesis of upstreaming for NetApp. NetApp's decision to use FreeBSD as a stable and efficient base for the ONTAP operating system was a practical decision made in the mid-2000s. A crucial challenge for NetApp was incorporating a user space with a proprietary kernel. However, FreeBSD's permissive BSD licensing perfectly aligned with NetApp's intellectual property and innovation strategies, making it an ideal choice. This led to the successful partnership between NetApp and FreeBSD, which has continued to thrive. Advantages of upstreaming for NetApp. NetApp's decision to actively contribute to FreeBSD through upstreaming demonstrates the company's commitment to open source principles. Moreover, it's a strategic move that offers them numerous benefits. These advantages reinforce NetApp's technological leadership and highlight the value of collaborative development in open source ecosystems. For example, enhanced code quality and security. NetApp contributes enhancements and fixes to FreeBSD, which undergo a thorough review by the FreeBSD community. The peer review process is highly valuable, as it involves scrutiny of NetApp's code by a diverse set of experts, improving code quality and robustness. This collective expertise helps identify and rectify potential security vulnerabilities, ensuring that FreeBSD and NetApp's products built on FreeBSD are more secure and reliable. There's also reduced maintenance overhead. Whenever NetApp integrates its improvements into FreeBSD, those enhancements become part of the FreeBSD project itself. This means that NetApp can significantly reduce the long-term maintenance burden. Whenever FreeBSD releases new versions, all of NetApp's prior contributions are included, eliminating the need for repetitive custom patching or reintegration efforts. This process results in smoother upgrades and updates for NetApp's products, improving operational efficiency and reducing the costs of maintaining separate code bases. There's also a strengthened community position and talent attraction. NetApp's involvement in the FreeBSD project by upstreaming enhances its reputation within the open source community. This recognition is not just symbolic, but also has practical implications for talent acquisition and retention. Besides compensation and company culture, open source developers are attracted to companies that contribute significantly to the projects they are passionate about. By positioning itself as a key contributor to FreeBSD, NetApp becomes more appealing to top-tier talent who value the opportunity to work on open source projects and make impactful contributions. They are also fostering collaborations and innovation. NetApp actively participates in the FreeBSD project by collaborating with other FreeBSD stakeholders. This upstreaming process facilitates innovation by enabling the exchange of ideas and solutions that may not have emerged in isolation. NetApp and its partners can develop new features, performance optimizations, and enhanced functionalities that benefit the broader FreeBSD community and its ecosystem through collaboration. Moreover, this collaborative effort helps NetApp identify potential strategic partnerships and collaborations to further its business and technological objectives. NetApp's open source participation strategy is based on upstreaming to FreeBSD. By contributing to the community, the company enriches the project and gains substantial benefits. This cycle of contribution and improvement helps NetApp build a strong technological foundation, fosters a vibrant community relationship, and positions the company at the forefront of innovation in the data management and storage domain. They also list a couple of real-world examples of NetApp's contributions. NetApp's involvement with FreeBSD showcases a commitment that transcends mere code contributions, highlighting a dynamic and multifaceted relationship with the open source community. Here's how NetApp has made a lasting impact on FreeBSD. So they did a lasting impact on FreeBSD. Community engagement and support. NetApp actively participates in the FreeBSD community with its developers attending and contributing to pivotal gatherings like BSD CAN and the FreeBSD Vendor Summit. These interactions are crucial for exchanging ideas, soliciting feedback, and strengthening the community fabric. Additionally, by hosting events for the FreeBSD Foundation, NetApp fosters environments ripe for collaboration and innovation, reinforcing the communal bonds that underpin open source projects. Technical contributions and financial support. Beyond community engagement, NetApp's dedication is evidenced through continuous technical contributions, including bug fixes and enhancements that bolster FreeBSD stability and performance. This technical stewardship is complemented by financial contributions to the FreeBSD Foundation, underlying NetApp's commitment to the project's longevity and vitality. A standout contribution from NetApp is the introduction of Beehive into FreeBSD in 2011, where it became part of the base system with FreeBSD 10.0 release, marking a significant advancement in FreeBSD's virtualization capabilities. Oh yes. This BSD-licensed hypervisor was integrated into the FreeBSD 10.0 release, exemplifying NetApp's role in driving innovative technologies in the FreeBSD ecosystem. Contributing Beehive enhances FreeBSD's feature set and showcased the potential of collaborative development between corporations and open source communities. They have also a commitment to quality and upstreaming efforts. NetApp underscores its dedication to FreeBSD through rigorous testing and quality assurance. A comprehensive continuous integration test suite run daily against the FreeBSD incorporated codebase helps identify and rectify issues promptly, ensuring reliability and performance. Over recent years, NetApp's strategy has led to nearly 300 changes being upstreamed to FreeBSD, with plans to further this contribution significantly. This sustained effort benefits NetApp in integrating improvements into FreeBSD's mainline, reducing future maintenance overhead and enriching the broader FreeBSD community with enhanced features and functionality. And last but not least, contribute to the FreeBSD project. Whenever you're mentoring, promoting FreeBSD, or participating in forums and mailing lists, your efforts drive innovation and growth of the project. Support the FreeBSD project today by joining our vibrant community and helping build our longstanding and growing open source ecosystem. So you can enhance FreeBSD by improving documentation, addressing bug reports, submitting code, and engaging in discussions. So all of these are separate links to each individual part, like mailing lists or forums. Every contribution, big or small, helps improve and evolve FreeBSD into a more stable, secure, and performant open source operating system. And thanks to NetApp for contributing over such a long time.
Yeah, it's good to see NetApp and other large organizations contributing to the FreeBSD project and other BSDs projects as well. In, you know, giving the source that they've worked on inside their organizations at considerable cost back into the BSD projects with a permissive license. People think you need to have, you know, GPL licenses to have large organizations contribute back to source code. This here is a clear indication that big organizations do give back into permissive licensed open source projects.
Yeah, and they benefit from that as well as taking. So this is back and forth beneficial for both partners.
Yeah, you know, one of those benefits is the fact that they don't need to manage a split brain tree outside of the project. So if you can push as much code back into the main tree, it means that you don't have to maintain as much code yourself and then having merge conflicts later on down the track when you're trying to do a large uplift to a newer version. Moving on to the news roundup. So make your own email server part 2, adding webmail and more with Nextcloud. So this is from Stefano Marinelli, and it complements the episode 553 that had part 1 in it. So if you are interested in this and you missed episode 553, I highly suggest going back and having a listen. So this is in Stefano's words, so I'll read it out to you. In the first part of this series, I detailed how to install and configure a complete mail server within a FreeBSD jail. While accessible via IMAP and SMTP, I intentionally did not cover installing a web interface. Installing a simple webmail is not complex, but nowadays we expect more integrated solutions, including contact books, which is synchronizable with computers and mobile devices, and calendars. For this reason, in this second part, I'll be utilizing Nextcloud. Nextcloud represents a comprehensive groupware solution today, extendable through apps that can be installed directly from the administration menu. This setup offers numerous advantages, including authenticating Nextcloud users through the IMAP server. Thus, a mail server user will automatically have a Nextcloud account, and a password changes on the mail will reflect on Nextcloud too. The ability to use integrated contacts, also in webmail, and calendars, and the option to attach or save attachments directly in Nextcloud. We will use the reverse proxy configured in part 1, which will pass connections from Nextcloud. First, a domain name must be defined, which will be used to connect to the server. In this example, I'll use nextcloud.example.com. To do this, enter the proxy's jail, Bastille console next Nginx proxy. Modify the file /user/local/etc/nginx/nginx.conf. Adjust the worker process so Nginx will start the number of processes equal to the number of calls on the machine it's running on, and create the virtual host for the Nextcloud. So there is some context here of the Nginx configuration. I won't read it out verbatim, but you can address it in the show notes. In the HTTP block, change the maximum file size limit and create the virtual host on the HTTP. We'll generate the HTTPS block and related certificates later. The proxy pass is in the HTTPS because later on, Nextcloud will respond in HTTPS. Although not necessary, this approach is simpler given the method used to install Nextcloud. Moreover, it allows for the reverse proxy to be on a different server than Nextcloud without the need for a VPN. Now I'll enable and start Nginx. Service Nginx enable, service Nginx start. After setting the listener port to 80, it's now appropriate to generate the certificate. A simple command will request the certificate and modify the Nginx configuration to accept the configurations over HTTPS. Certbot /nginx-d nextcloud.example.com. Upon completion of this command, the virtual host for the HTTPS will be correctly generated and an automatic redirect will be set up for all connections arriving on HTTP to be moved over to HTTPS. Exit the jail and it's now time to create the jail for Nextcloud. Bastille create -BNC 14.0 release 192.168.123.5/24 on bridge 0. Enter the jail and add the default gateway in rc.conf. After restarting the jail, it will be now possible to install Nextcloud. FreeBSD has a fairly up-to-date package, but when it comes to web applications, I prefer to have more control. Usually I install everything manually, but for Nextcloud, I found an interesting script made by Gabran Khan, which takes care of everything, i.e. installing Apache, PHP, ClamAV, all dependencies. It'll also configure Nextcloud, make it almost ready for use. Since Gibran skipped or was structured for version 27, used PHP 8.2 and had other small things that were not perfect in my use, I decided to modify it slightly and mainly support Nextcloud 28 and PHP 8.3. Therefore, the description that follows will be related to my fork available here. So I entered the NC jail, downloaded the script, and started with the configuration. A configuration file will be generated that will need to be modified. The file is install.conf. You will certainly need to change the host name, insert the one that you have chosen, in this case, nextcloud.example.com, and unless you are in Italy, I'd suggest changing the country code and time zone. Once completed, you can proceed with the actual installation, .install.sh. At the end of the installation, the login data will appear, which will also be saved in a file named nextcloud.example.com_reference.txt. The installer will also set up a cron job executed by the user www, which will handle every 5 minutes the background operations required for Nextcloud to function properly. In some cases, I've noticed that it's necessary to modify the cron job, save it, and then it will start working correctly. If that's the case, simply open it with cron tab -uwwe, save and exit. Now modify the Nextcloud configuration. Replace the overwrite.cli.url with your domain. Add the proxy to the trusted proxies. If not present, insert the entire block. Modify the http.conf file and change the listen directive to listen *:443 and then restart Apache. To simplify things, it's advisable to make a modification in etc hosts. Add a line to ensure the mail server can be reached via the LAN through its domain name. Therefore, add the line 192.168.123.3mail.example.com. In this manner, when Nextcloud attempts to connect to the mail server, it will do so directly over the LAN. This direct connection is essential for the IMAP authentication plugin, as it verifies that the SSL certificate of the mail server matches the host name being called. Now log into the Nextcloud with the admin credentials that the installer provided you earlier. Nextcloud is now installed and initialized. We need to perform two operations to install the Snappy Mail app if you want to use it, but generally I recommend it over the integrated mail client in Nextcloud and enable IMAP authentication to avoid duplicate users, i.e. mail user and Nextcloud user. That's a good tip. I might go and check out Snappy Mail. Click on the menu at the top right, the big A, and then go to Apps. Under Integration, you will now be able to install Snappy Mail and External User Authentication, which, however, is currently listed as untested because it's been tested for a previous version of Nextcloud, but it works on version 28.2. You will have to click it twice because the first click only enables the untested app. Once the apps are installed, go to the Administration Settings and Additional Settings, and then to the Snappy Mail Administration panel. Now add your domain, so click Add Domain. The domain name will be that of your emails example.com in this case. Therefore, in the IMAP server field, enter the name of the mail server, mail.example.com, and set the security to the start TLS. Do the same for SMTP and sieve. Perform the test using the username and password of an existing valid mailbox, and once everything is validated, save. You'll now be able to log into your webmail. On top the top bar of Nextcloud, there will be two icons, one for the integrated webmail client and the other for Snappy Mail. The integrated webmail client has some features that are not present in Snappy Mail, such as delayed sending of messages, so it may be useful to keep both active. Currently, Snappy Mail will require a username and password every time you connect, even if you are already logged into Nextcloud, but it is possible in user settings to enable automatic login once authenticated in Nextcloud. Now is the time to configure IMAP authentication. Return to the Nextcloud jail and modify the Nextcloud configuration and add this block, and it's listed below. Example.com in the fourth field is used to limit the authentication scope to that domain. More information can be found on the official plugin page. After saving, you will be able to log out as admin and log in with your mail account. Unless there are errors, you'll be catapulted into your new user created and authorized through IMAP authentication. Congratulations, you are now able to use Nextcloud by logging in with your email credentials and also use it as a basis for webmail, leveraging the contacts module for email addresses address book as well. Nextcloud can offer intriguing prospects for everyday use. In addition to its seamless integration with mobile devices, tools like Nextcloud Talk and Note will enable users to avoid the use of external solutions and maintain control over their data. It will also be possible to synchronize contacts and calendars with mail contacts like Thunderbird or address books of various stationary and mobile devices. The procedure varies depending on the devices used, but it's just a matter of synchronizing via CalDAV and CardDAV. Alternative, you can set up ZPush and use the Microsoft Exchange ActiveSync AES protocol. That will be described in part 3 of this series. Addendum: adding antivirus support to spam filtering. The automatic installation script alongside Nextcloud installed another component, including CamAV, to check uploaded files in real time. We can leverage this installation since CamAV consumes significant resources. It makes no sense to install two instances and integrate this instance of CamAV with RSpamD to also perform antivirus checks on emails. So it goes into modifying the clamd.conf file and then restart clamd to listen on the port that you've done in the clamd.conf file. Return the mail to the mail jail with Bastille console mail, and then create the file for antivirus.conf. Link is in the notes of this blog article. Restart RSpamD in the mail jail, and from this point on, viruses will be automatically rejected. And that's the end of the post. So there is a part 3 coming out shortly, so keep an eye on the podcast and we will bring it to you fresh as it hits.
Yep. Got to collect the whole set.
Sure do.
And next up is also a tutorial for running PuTTY on Apple Silicon, for those of you who want to do a bit of cross-compiling, I would say. But let's see what this is going. This is over at Oliver Epper's blog and starts with, I have updated the FreeBSD package for PJS IP and volunteered to take over the maintainership of that package. Thank you. To me, ARM and ARCH64 is even more important than AMD64, so naturally I wanted to build or at least test the package on ARCH64. The normal way in FreeBSD is to run PuTTY together with QEMU emulation for cross-building, but it takes literally forever and wasn't even successful. What works really well is running FreeBSD for ARCH64 under QEMU virtualization with Apple's hypervisor. In fact, that is so slick that I've set up Launch Daemon to always start FreeBSD together with macOS. So what do you do there? QEMU configuration, even though... Note from me, I found UTM as the Apple kind of, it's not Apple native, but it's a hypervisor on Apple, similar to what VirtualBox provides in early stages, but you can either emulate or virtualize, depending on what kind of architecture you provide. So this is just another way of doing it. But here we use QEMU. Back to the article. Sadly, there is a bug with QEMU hypervisor framework that affects IPv6 in a guest when bridging it's used, and the bridge connects to the local network via Wi-Fi. When the virtual network connects to a bridge that is connected via Wi-Fi, the guest can successfully obtain an IPv6 address via router advertisement, but it cannot receive packages via IPv6. Very strange. IPv4 is fine. IPv6 over a shared connection is fine, and IPv6 over the bridged connection is fine if the bridge is not connected to via Wi-Fi. So if you use a Mac Mini as a build server and plug in a cable, you're absolutely fine. If you need Wi-Fi, you cannot use the bridge if you need IPv6. I hope this will get fixed. Any pointers are very welcome. So he provides the QEMU config, which is more or less straightforward. So it's a couple of calls to QEMU system-AR64, no VGA, no defaults, dash device virtual GPU, display Cocoa, show cursor equals on, CPU host, SMP, CPU sets to 4, sockets 1, cores 2, and threads 2. Machine word and some a long list with a couple of devices, and of course starting from FreeBSD 14.0 release to boot from. The whole list is of course provided in the blog post. So this whole thing should be saved in optvm/putrearstart.sh. Delete the line that says dash no graphic for now, or for good if you always want to display it to the build machine. I don't. I prefer connecting via SSH and never want to interact with the machine directly. A little hint. If you use a cable connection, you can use bridge networking. You should give your device a permanent MAC address, and he provides instructions how to do that. Then create the disks. I use two disks, 1.qcow2 for the system and 2.qcow2 for PutRear and the ports collection. Create them with QEMU image, create-f qcow 1.qcow2. The first is 10 gigs and the second is 128 gigs. You can use raw files and they will be faster, but then you need a slightly modified config. Then you need to say mkfile 10g1.raw, and you need to include them in the actual QEMU system call where you say derive if equals none and then the file name equals then the path to your raw disk device. He also provides instructions how to add that. I go with the slower qcow2 files, mainly because they are sparse files and I cannot afford to give up so much disk space. Yeah. Okay. Next is to copy the EFI and EFI vars into place. Depending on the guest operating system, there are different ways you can bring up a guest machine. He chooses EFI for all his machines because it works with every modern guest OS. So once you have QEMU installed via brew install QEMU, you can either copy the UEFI firmware and the UEFI variables storage files in place or change the path to a UEFI file in the VM config. Don't use one variable storage for multiple machines though. And he provides instructions what to copy from where. Then the first start in installation, make sure that you have deleted the line dash no graphic and then invoke the script. You need sudo in order for the QEMU helper to set up the bridge. And then the VM should boot like a normal computer and you can install FreeBSD. The hint there is the computer will start with an EFI shell, tap exit, and you'll be presented with a UI where you can choose your boot device. Then there's a section on the FreeBSD initial config. This is optional, but he finds it useful. In order to speed up the start of the virtual machine, add this to bootloader conf, auto boot delay equals -1, and BSD disable equals yes. Make sure that you can reach the machine via SSH so that you can add dash no graphic back in the VM config, and you should be able to restart the machine via reboot and to stop the VM via init 0. Then he provides the XML to modify the launch daemon. If you want the machine to be automatically started by a launch daemon when the Mac boots, create the following file in /library/launch daemon and then your own namespace .vms.putrear.plist, and it's a couple of lines of XML where this basically loads that start shell script and runs it and keeps it alive. And to install the service with sudo launch ctl load /library/launch daemon, the one you just created. Then putrear. Before installing putrear, let's create a zpool and the appropriate file systems. To use two .qcow2 as a ZFS pool, enter zpool create tank /dev/vtbd1. And then create user local poudrier and user ports, dist files. Why did not too fancy? If you followed this podcast for a while, then you he provides also instructions how to sign the packages that you've built with poudrier. Excellent. So that you have proof that you've built actually these files yourself on your own systems and not trust any kind of except. Ah, well. Then he has a note at the end, the poudrier config, edit user local etc poudrier conf according to your needs. So he changed the zpool, added his tank that he created, the FreeBSD host is your mirror, the git ports URL is your GitHub or official GitHub mirror, and the package repo signing key that we just created to sign the finished packages. Excellent. That is straightforward, and a lot of Mac users can now build on their Apple Silicon poudrier in bigger.
You're a Mac user, aren't you? Benedict, you're a Mac user, aren't you?
Oh, yes, I am.
Do you,
guilty as charged.
Are you on the Apple Silicon yet, or are you still on the
Yes, I'm on the M1.
Okay.
And yeah, I will probably check this out.
Yeah. Do you use any virtualization currently on the Mac? Because I'd be interested. I'd be interested to understand if there's like a how close it is to the metal for QEMU. I'm wondering, you know, if there is a performance, like a performance penalty working.
So if you, I currently use, since I was like, M1 is cool, but hey, VirtualBox doesn't work anymore because it's an x86 CPU. But someone pointed me to UTM. It's mac.getutm.app, or you just Google for UTM and Mac. And then you get this hypervisor that I was mentioning earlier, where you can virtualize various systems, and you can say either emulate those systems, which is a bit slower because it has to, you know, do all the syscall translations itself, or you virtualize, which is a bit faster but can only run supported applications that run on ARCH64.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I'm curious on this because I'm curious on platforms, and you know, the Raspberry Pis are sort of limited in what they are, and
yeah,
you
know, as a build server,
yeah, and it's really, you know, that you look at some of the other dev kits and they get quite expensive. It's trying to find that right balance, you know, the price point of consumer PC hardware, or trying to find the equivalent of that in ARM architecture. But you know,
yeah,
hey, maybe something I don't know, and you know, if anybody else out there knows more about ARM architecture and where I can get sort of PC consumer grade, so it goes as fast as a PC but doesn't cost, you know, the stratospheric prices that some of those initial pieces of equipment came out with. You know, please send in an email to feedback@bsdnow.tv and please guide me in the right direction.
And it's probably not just you looking for something like that, because, hey, we have a bunch of people in the community who maybe want to speed up their own poudrier builds this way, and what solution is better than just sharing it? Yeah, having one is good, but we just need to find it. So this UTM, I just used it in the last semester to demo stuff on, you know, on FreeBSD in a virtual machine, and students could follow along in their own virtual machines if they were not on the Mac or not yet on Apple Silicon. But nowadays, the Mac you buy, they have all Apple Silicon, so this is the hypervisor that is going to be the one. And it's community created, and works so far so good for me. The few times I started to demo something and then shut it down again. But yeah, this is one that you could probably also use to build packages.
And finally, over on the roundup, we've got a article on 104fox.blogspot.com. And it goes, one less Unixy option for 32-bit Power PC. Most of you are still using a Power Mac as a daily or occasional driver, are probably either running Linux, Tiger, or Leopard, and a minority of OS 9. Despite many distributions no longer shipping 32-bit Power PC installs, Gentoo Linux has still a specific support along with a few others, as does a Dell Linux, if you like Musl for breakfast. Still, for server duties, where I come from, you bring on the BSDs. In this blog, you've already met my long-suffering NetBSD Macintosh 2CI, which is still stuck, still trucking to this day, and more recently, my also NetBSD G4 Mac Mini, which later needed effectively a logic board swap. But I also have a Quadro 605 with a full 040 running NetBSD I use for utility tasks, and at one time I ran an intermediate incarnation of Gopher, floodgap.com, on the Power Macintosh 7300 with a Somnet G3 running NetBSD 2. I stuffed that system with a full gig of RAM and a SATA card, and it did very well until I got the current Power6 server in 2010. NetBSD has the widest support, continuing to run on most 68,000 and PCI Power Macs to this day, leaving out only the Nubus Power Macs, which aren't really supported by much of anything anymore, sadly. However, OpenBSD works fine on New World Macs, and FreeBSD has a very mature 32-bit PowerPC port, or should I say soon, will have one since starting in FreeBSD 15. 13.x is currently released. ARM V6, 32-bit Intel, and 32-bit PowerPC support will likely be removed. No new 32-bit support will be added, including for RISC-V. Even though I have a large number of NetBSD systems, I still like FreeBSD, and one of my remote island systems runs it. The differences between BSDs are more subtle than with Linux distributions, but you can still enjoy the different flavors that result. And I even ported a little FreeBSD code to the NetBSD kernel so I could support automatic restarts after a power failure on the G4 Mini. The fact that the user land and kernel are better matched together probably make the BSDs better desktop clients too, especially since on Big Endian, we're already used to some packages just not building right, so we don't lose a whole lot by running it. Usually, those are the same packages that wouldn't build on anything but Linux anyway. This isn't the end for the G5, which should still be able to run the 64-bit version of FreeBSD, and OpenBSD hasn't voiced any firm plans to cut the 32-bit loose. However, NetBSD support the widest range of Macs, including the Macs far older than any Power Mac. And frankly, if you want to use the Unix on a Power Mac, you have a reasonable confidence it will still be running on it for years to come. It's undeniably the one with the best track record. That's some seriously old hardware, stretching the lifetime out on that hardware for quite some time. Very impressed.
Speaking of hardware, in our Beastie Bits this week, we have Powering Up the Future, the new FreeBSD cluster in Chicago. This is a blog post from the FreeBSD Foundation, and they write that they recently made a significant investment of over $100,000 to install a server cluster in Chicago. This investment aims to strengthen the infrastructure of the FreeBSD project, improve its capabilities, and provide better services to its users. To support this expansion, the foundation has partnered with NYI, which has generously contributed 4 racks in the Chicago facility. Oh yeah, so they have a picture here. It's basically blinking machines in a rack. So the new cluster configuration is designed to optimize the FreeBSD project's operational efficiency and includes 2 routers for direct network traffic, 5 package builders aimed at accelerating the package release process, 3 general purpose servers. These will enhance the availability and performance of the FreeBSD project's public and developer-facing services like Bugzilla, Git, Fabricator, and Wiki, and others. Then they have also 2 package mirrors in there, one hosted in the new cluster in Chicago and one hosted by ISC in California. These are part of the FreeBSD project's growing network of package.freebsd.org and download.freebsd.org servers, strategically positioned around the world to offer faster package downloads. Then they have 2 CI servers to improve the speed and efficacy of automated code testing, and 1 admin bastion, a secure entry point for managing the cluster, which runs the cluster administration team cluster ADM. Tools, cluster, DNS, monitoring, and other services needed to administer this collection of systems. This hardware setup is expected to significantly improve the processing capabilities and service responsiveness of the FreeBSD project. And they describe a little bit the installation of the new cluster. The cluster admin team played a crucial role in the integration phase of the new clusters, so thanks to those and to, of course, FreeBSD Foundation for giving the money to make that happen in the first place. For example, cluster admin did the hardware compatibility and firmware debugging. Several initial hurdles had to be overcome to ensure the server firmware was compatible with FreeBSD. The cluster relies on being able to netboot machines and requires reliable out-of-band management. They also did network configuration and automation. After the servers could reliably boot, the network was configured, including the cluster internal DNS, packet filter rules, and BGP sessions to the internet. As well as automation and system provisioning, the team's automation tools largely automate installing and configuring servers. After overcoming some bootstrapping issues using a temporary FreeBSD installation, the servers were netbooted into the cluster installation image and installed using the standard cluster builds. They also did monitoring and management integration. The team installed and configured a monitoring proxy on the admin server, integrating the new site into the project's central monitoring system. This allowed for efficient management and troubleshooting of the cluster, ensuring stability and performance. And last but not least, final system installation and network services set up. The team concluded the integration work by reinstalling the admin server, using the tooling automation, setting up routing and firewall configurations, and bringing up the BGP sessions on the fiber uplinks. This setup ensures the new cluster was operational and optimized for performance and security. A small section is about the impact on future prospects. This new setup provides faster and more reliable services and better positions the FreeBSD project to serve the global user community's requirements to adapting to technological developments. And donations to the FreeBSD Foundation support work like this and make it happen in the first place.
Excellent. And the last thing over on the Beastie Bits today is getting Dragonfly BSD 6.5 snapshot. So 6.5 is a development release. Typically the dot releases are the standard release. So a snapshot release on a Acer Nitro AN515-51/58-XXX series laptop. These laptops typically come in a variety of hardware SKU configurations. They configure AMD 7000 and above Ryzen CPUs or an Intel i12, i13, i14, 500, 700, 900 CPUs, DDR4 or DDR5 RAM, Thunderbolt 4, 165 to 144 Hertz display panels, AMD Radeon graphics, integrated Intel graphics, NVIDIA 30XX or 40XX graphics, integrated Intel Wi-Fi 6, 6E, AX2XX series, integrated MediaTek MT7921 Wi-Fi or variants, killer Ethernet E2600, was Realtek, now Intel, Realtek and NVIDIA audio, Bluetooth 5.1, integrated cameras, micro SDTM card readers, and internal two NVMe drive connectors and one SATA connector. So I'm not going to go into this article too much, but we thought we'd, it's very, very long. It's very detailed. So for those that want to get cracking on Dragonfly on modern hardware, highly recommend reading this article. But we just wanted to highlight it today. So for those that are curious, can follow the step-by-step procedure through to get it up and running on a similar hardware. Just be note, there's some security and caution notes down the bottom of the article and just some tips around releases of OpenBSD 7.4 and FreeBSD 14 and 15 and even something for Ubuntu. So just don't forget those bits at the bottom of the article.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have no feedback and questions this week. Please send us more to feedback@bsdnow.tv so that we can, you know, put this in this section. But we, at this point, we alternate a little bit with user feedback. And in the other episode, we have the Beastie Bits, which are also popular. So I guess this is a nice mixture.
Yeah, I want to find a bit more about ARM. So if you've got any sort of ARM tips for ARM hardware, please send them through.
Yeah, right. So give tips, ARM hardware to Jason. I'm still on the Nextcloud thingy, the home server things. And yeah, let's see what Tom asks for. He can now look at this nice Dragonfly BSD setup. Yeah. Maybe he can do it at home or something.
Get cracking with some Dragonfly on his new high-speed internet connection.
Conferences are still going in terms of, for example, EuroBSDCon is still looking for papers.
Call for papers is still out for EuroBSDCon. Mm-hmm. So please, if you've got an idea, please look at the criteria and put a submission in, because the more the merrier.
Yep. Or if you're just too shy to talk, just consider going in the first place. BSDCon is at the end of May. And we will be having a whole conference going on. And I guess they will publish the schedule soonish, once they contacted everyone and figured out the final schedule. And so this is what you can also look forward to. I guess some of the talks from Asia BSDCon have been recorded and should show up either on YouTube or on papers.freebsd.com or on from linked from their website. Don't quote me on that. So that was also nice. I saw a couple of pictures on the social medias. So apparently they had a good time there. And thanks for everything. Everyone who organized that one. BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups. And Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud, so that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what data is duplicated so that bandwidth can be saved. It then assembles your data into compressed blocks, encrypts them with your local private key that never leaves your system, and then uploads those encrypted blocks to the cloud. So even if someone is able to obtain your backed up data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code to make sure that it does what we say it does. Tarsnap also does bug bounties if you find errors in the code. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse to not have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more. And I think that's everything we have for you today. Have a nice week. And until next week, where we have another episode, which is called 556.
Catch you later.
Bye.